Psychology of Learning. Today we have another sort of different topic than we've covered for most of the semester. This recording will deal with observational learning, or learning by observation. We have four learning outcomes from this presentation. First is to be able to define and cite examples of social and asocial learning, so you'll have expertise in those two types of observational learning. You'll know those two terms, social and asocial, by the time we're finished. You'll be able to differentiate theories and formulas between social and asocial learning. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the theories behind those two types of learning, and we'll talk about a mathematical depiction of both. We'll cite samples of over-imitation so that you're able to come up with those later on if someone were to ask you. And we will ensure that you're able to describe features of Bandura's social cognitive theory as it applies to observational learning. So we should start off by defining our basic term here, observational learning itself. And this, in fact, has changed over time. The definition of observational learning used to be learning from the experiences of a model, so watching some other animal do some task and learning from watching it do that task, usually a conspecific animal, that meaning an animal of the same species as you. More recent research suggests that we should adopt a broader definition of observational learning than that, because it seems like animals and people can both learn by observing just events more generally and the consequences of those events. So they can learn from watching other animals do things, which is a little less frequent, but they can also learn from seeing things that aren't necessarily animal models or watching events transpire and learning from just the consequences of the events. This allows us two types of observational learning, social and asocial observational learning. The social version, on slide 5 now, of observational learning typically involves observing the behavior of another individual, again, usually the same species as the observer, and then the consequences of that model's behavior. The experience can be represented like it is on the slide here, O, M sub B, arrow, and then S plus or minus. What that means is an observer views a model's behavior, so the observer is the O, the model's behavior is M sub B, and its positive or negative consequences, the S plus or the S minus. If the consequences of the model's behavior strengthen the observer's tendency to behave in a similar way, we say that that behavior has been vicariously reinforced. Same definition of reinforcement that we've used before. If the behavior is more likely to happen again, then we say that the animal has experienced reinforcement. The only difference here is that that reinforcement is vicarious. If the likelihood, on the other hand, that the observer will do the behavior in the future is weakened, lessened, in other words, if the consequences of the model's behavior weaken that observer's tendency to behave in a similar way, we'd say that that behavior has been vicariously punished because it's now less likely to happen. Usually the consequences that reinforce or punish the model's behavior have a similar effect on the observer's behavior. You can maybe imagine really complicated situations where that would not remain true, but we're just going to deal with these relatively simple examples today and in this class. So a hypothetical example might help, and I'm going to use this idea called the money box. So you see that in the top corner of slide 5 here. Now imagine you see a woman seated in front of a table, and there's a large box on the table. The box is like Something like, let's say, 6 inches tall or so, a large box. Has a sign on it. The sign says, "The money box, take the money and run." You slide open a little door on the front, and there is a hole in it that's like about the size of your arm, and there's a big stack of $20 bills inside when you slide the door open. You can see the stack of 20s. The woman takes one, she smiles, she shuts the door, and she leaves. Now you are able to enter the room with the money box in it. What are you gonna do? So stop and think about this for a second before you move on to the next slide, to slide six. Think about what you feel like you might do in that situation. Now, researchers ran an equivalent study with chimps and grapes. An observer chimp would watch 58 different trials. They would watch 58 chimps go in, open a box, take a grape from inside, and leave. A non-observer would see, obviously, no chimps go and do that. All observers solved the puzzle right away. They walked in, slid the door open, took a grape, and left. And most of them actually slid the door in the same direction. The picture here has it slid to the left. If a chimp watched other chimps slide to the left, they were very likely to also slide the box to the left, even if it could go to the right. Less than half of the control subjects, the chimps that didn't see anybody model it for them, solved it in their first try. Another study's been done on 3 to 5 year old children with stickers, in a sort of money box kind of situation. In the experimental condition, the children saw 15 different children open and get stickers out, and all those observers slid the door in the same direction. But on the other hand, it was actually quite easy for the control subjects to also solve the puzzle. The 3 to 5 year olds had no trouble figuring out how to open the box and get a sticker out, even if they hadn't watched a model. But the difference between, in this case, the observers and the non-observers is that the observers all happened to slide the door to the box in the same direction. So, as in those money box experiments, many studies of the social version of observational learning involve these kinds of simple pieces of problem solving. Herbert and Harsh in 1944 did one of the older studies in which they observed, excuse me, studied observational learning in cats using models. So, the pictures are pretty great here. We're on slide 7. They designed a structure that allowed as many as 4 cats at a time to watch a model cat, as the cat worked at solving one of 5 problems. The one you're seeing here is the turntable problem. So there is a bird's eye view in the bottom left, and then next to that image is kind of a 3D depiction of what that might have looked like in person. So the model cat would have 30 learning trials while the observer cats looked on. Some observers would watch all 30 trials, others watched only the last 15 trials, and of course there were other cats that watched none of the trials. The results showed that the observer cats outperformed the model cats, because essentially the model cats were non-observers. They were going at the task brand new. And even more than that, the more observing a cat did, the better it performed. You might have thought that cats seeing just the last 15 trials would see the model cat be very good at the task and would learn it better. But in fact, the cats that saw more trials learned more, no matter how good the model cat was at the task. The models, according to the graph on the right, look to have taken an average of about 115 seconds to solve the problem. The cats that observed 15 trials took considerably less time. They took only about 57 seconds on average to solve the problems. And then the cats that observed 30 trials were solving the problems on average as quickly as 16 seconds. So they learned quite a lot from watching each other. Not all studies of observational learning, though, do involve these little problem-solving skills. Levy et al. In 1974 studied the effects of model reinforcement and punishment on picture preferences in children. So, no problem solving to be done here, just sort of learning about whether a child sees reinforcement and punishment of another child and uses it to influence their future interactions. So, in an experiment, children from preschool age to 6th grade looked on as a model went through a series of picture pairs indicating which of the two in the pair they preferred. So they just watched another child look at two pictures side by side and say, I like that one, or I like the one on the left, or I like the one on the right. I just sort of watched them go through this process. Each of those choices resulted, though, in approval, disapproval, or a neutral consequence from a nearby adult. So after every preference was shown, so the child, let's say the model child said, oh, I like the picture on the left, the adult they were with would either say, great, or would say something neutral, or would say, that's not right. And then the observers, after watching all this happen, went through the same picture pairs and then were asked to indicate their own preferences. And when they did that, the results showed that the children, the observer children, were influenced by the consequences of the choices that their model made. The observer children tended to prefer pictures that won approval for the model and to reject pictures that resulted in criticism of the model. So they didn't necessarily learn a new skill or learn how to solve some kind of complex or simple problem. What they did is they learned about approval of one picture versus another based on how the adult responded to the model child's choices. So they used that bit of reinforcement and punishment to inform their own future choices. Let's move now into some asocial observational learning examples. So the asocial version of observational learning consists of an animal learning from some kind of observed event in the absence of a model. So the equation changes slightly differently. You've got just E before the S plus or S minus, because there is no model performing a behavior. We've got E just indicating event. So an observer views an event and its positive or negative consequences. It's really probably not new to you that this happens. Not news to you. People, of course, learn from our surroundings in all kinds of situations in the absence of models. The difference, or the reason that it's presented as this different and new thing, is that this kind of learning wasn't thought of as observational learning in the past. It was thought about very differently. It was theorized about quite differently. And only more recently have psychologists started to group social and asocial learning as both fitting under the umbrella of observation. So you could consider a variation on the money box problem. Imagine an empty room with a table and chair. Two men enter carrying the money box. One is taller than the other, and as they carry the box, the shorter man stumbles a little bit, and his side of the box drops quite low, and the panel slides to the left, showing you that there is a hole in the box, and inside the hole you can see a thick envelope. And so then they set the box down on the table, and the panel slides back to its original spot and covers the hole. Then an experimenter takes you into the room and says you can sit at the table, face the box, solve the problem, and then leaves the room. What are you going to do? Well, you may not necessarily obey the command on the box and take the money and run. You'll probably slide the door to the left and take the envelope out, even though you didn't see a model do this. And you might then open the envelope and try to figure out what's inside of it. And you may or may not take the money in that case. So you, no matter what you did, you would have learned a lot about what's going on and whether to open the box and why by seeing the door slide open accidentally. It was just an event. It had no behavior and it had no model. So if observational learning can happen without another person, what is the thing that makes social learning truly social? Could it just be represented the same way? Couldn't it be in that we're learning from the event? We're not necessarily learning from the experience of the model. We're just learning from the feedback the model gets from the environment. Or does the presence of the model change something in a meaningful way? So for this, I'll offer you a quote by Michael Tomasello from 1998, in which he wrote, "If a mother chimpanzee rolls a log and eats the insects underneath, her child will likely follow suit. but the youngster would have learned the same thing if the wind, rather than the mother, had caused the log to roll over and expose the ants. The research suggests that this statement maybe goes a little too far, and that there are differences in what is learned in the presence and absence of a model. This is an important question because we have to wonder how much of the learning that occurs in observing a model is due to the actions specifically of the model, and how much is due to observing the physical events that occur after the model's actions. So in this chimp example, if a chimp watched its mother move a log, it would learn about how to pick up a log. It would be able to watch the mother's physical movements to discover exactly how to get the best leverage to roll the log, where to go on the log to find the spot you can roll from, what you need to know, and all the other things you need to know about where to place your body and how exactly to push. Whereas if the wind rolled the log over, it wouldn't learn those things. It would just learn that rolled logs have ants underneath. So it would have to figure out the other part for itself. And this is the main difference between social and asocial observational learning, which is these instances of imitation. So traditionally, we define imitate as behaving in a way that resembles the behavior of a model. Slightly more broadly, you might say to perform an observed act, whether that act is modeled or not. But most research on imitation involves models, so we'll focus on imitation as mainly the performance of the modeled behavior. And what we see is that people tend to imitate observed behavior even when it is irrelevant to producing the reinforcement that the model received. In fact, people seem to be almost compulsive about how closely we imitate the details of modeled behavior. I'll give you a couple examples of this. In 2007, Lyons, Young, and Keel trained 3 to 5-year-old children to identify actions that were irrelevant to the solution of problems, just to see whether they could figure it out. So they would have a situation, for example, like a jar would have a toy dinosaur inside. They'd watch an adult model tap the jar with a feather and then unscrew the lid and then remove the toy. And then they would ask the child, which of those things had to happen, which was necessary to get the dinosaur, and which of those actions was kind of silly. And when the child answered correctly, they praised them quite a lot. They go, yes, exactly, of course, you're very smart. And if they were incorrect, they give them feedback. Say, well, actually, tapping with a feather was silly because it didn't do anything to open the jar. So after that training instance, a new kind of container was presented with a toy turtle inside. And they watched a model get the turtle out, and the demonstration again included irrelevant steps. And the question was whether the child would imitate those steps after having just discussed how silly it was to tap the jar with the feather to get the dinosaur out. So they were given the container with the turtle inside, and we thought maybe that the researchers thought the child might feel some pressure to imitate the adult's irrelevant acts if the adult were present. So the experimenter always had the model leave the room. Before leaving, the model would always suggest that the child remove the turtle from the container however you want, was the direct quote. So despite those efforts to discourage imitation and discourage irrelevant acts, the children imitated the model. The children who took on the task of removing the turtle without the model do it, without watching the model do it, were more successful and they were also successful, and they did not engage in any unnecessary actions. So you can see the figure on slide 12 here. We've got percent producing the irrelevant action. And so the lighter bars are the children who watched an adult do the irrelevant action, and the darker bars are the children who did not. And so in most conditions here, they very rarely did irrelevant actions. And this is an instance of a term I gave at the beginning of this recording, which is over-imitation. Despite all efforts to get the children to only do what was necessary, they still performed irrelevant actions before opening containers to get toys. Lest you think that over-imitation is a result of immaturity and something only kids do, it in fact seems like humans over-imitate even more as they age. Great study by Tenney, Colin Tomasello had children look on as a model obtained a toy in a box by opening a swinging door. The door could be pushed or pulled to open it. Some children saw a model open the door by pushing it. Others saw a model pull the door open. The proportion of children who matched the model increased steadily with age from 12 to 24 months. So a one-year-old child was somewhat likely to do whatever the model had done, either push or pull the door to open it. And then a two-year-old was much more likely to directly over-imitate the model. So as the children get older, as they get supposedly smarter and more reasonable, they start to over-imitate. Nicola McGuigan and colleagues in 2007 found that 5-year-old children were more likely to over-imitate than 3-year-olds in a slightly different study. And so the suggestion we get from all this is that over-imitation might progress steadily into adulthood. So these are some sort of general fun findings and some of the more interesting and influential things we know about social and asocial observational learning, and we haven't talked at all yet about how they work. So there are two main theories of observational learning that I'd like you to take away from this course. There is the social cognitive theory of Albert Bandura, and there is the operant learning model. Both of these theories focus on the social form, though the operant model can apply to the asocial form as well. So we'll mostly be talking about social learning here. You might already know the name Albert Bandura. You might, in fact, remember a study of his. He did the famous Bobo doll experiment, which I've got a short little YouTube link to on slide 15. Pause and check that out if you like before you go forward. Bandura developed a theory that focuses on cognitive processes. So he does not deny in this theory that environmental and biological events can influence behavior, but in his view, it's the cognitive processes that account for learning from models specifically. It is the things going on inside the person, inside the mind, that enable us to learn by observation. So his theory identifies 4 kinds of cognitive processes. They are attentional, retentional, motor reproductive, and motivational. So we'll go through what each of these 4 means more specifically. First, attentional processes. They have to do with the individual directing their attention to the relevant aspects of the model's behavior and the consequences of that behavior. I have a specific quote from Bandura himself here. He said, "It involves self-directed exploration of the environment and construction of meaningful perception from ongoing modeled events." The term self-directed is critical here because it suggests that what determines where we look and what we listen to originates inside us. So that puts the organism itself as the sort of driver here. The word construction is also important. It indicates that what we derive from the things we observe is not so much the product of all those things than something going on inside us. So our actions, our learning is not determined by the environment. It's determined by what we take from the environment mentally. Retentional processes involve representing the model's behavior in some way, usually in words or images, to enable recall or memory. So you could think of retention very much like memory in this case. Bandura wrote that after modeling stimuli have been coded with images or words for memory representation, they function as mediators for response retrieval and reproduction. A very fancy way of saying that we put something in memory, and that something is probably words or images that gives us the ability to remember what we saw the model do. He gives the example in his original writings of observing a model who follows a certain route to get to a particular location. The model's movements can be encoded in images, so to speak, in that maybe they pass objects or scenes along the way. Or it could be coded as a sequence of right and left turns, RRLRLL. Either way, the model's movements are being encoded through what he calls the retentional process. Can also include covert rehearsal. Imagine that you're watching the model go, and as you do, you're maybe repeating right, left, right, left, right, left to yourself to keep track of where and when they turn. That's also, again, part of the retentional process. The motor reproductive processes are involved in using the symbolic representations that the retentional process is built to guide action. So this is the act of recalling and actually using whatever you've memorized, whatever you've attempted to remember, to guide your own actual motor movements. Bandura wrote about motor reproductive processes. It is assumed that reinstatement of representational schemes provides a basis for self-instruction on how component responses must be combined and sequenced to produce new patterns of behavior. So what he's saying here is that is essentially this same thing, that in order to bring back a memory and actually use it, or rather when you bring back a memory and use it, it is what informs you, what instructs you how exactly you're going to then physically move. The last process in Bandura's social cognitive theory is the motivational processes, in which we evaluate the consequences of our imitation. So he wrote that when a favorable incentive is introduced, observational learning promptly emerges in action. In other words, the consequences are going to affect our behavior and are going to affect our expectations. So we'll see those experienced by the model vicariously, but also importantly here, we'll experience them ourselves as we go on imitating. These are, of course, hypothetical, and as written by Bandura, very sort of highfalutin in their language, but we can illustrate them really nicely with an example. So suppose your aunt points to a wall safe and says, "I'm going to open that safe and then lock it again. If you can open it, you can keep whatever you find inside." She then opens the safe. She turns the dial clockwise to 20, counterclockwise to 40, clockwise to 20 again, pulls down the handle, swings open the door, and then immediately closes it back up. Now, so as you are watching her work on opening the door, you direct your attention to which way she turns the safe dial and the numbers at which she stops. So that's that first attentional process. You may also represent her behavior by picturing some kind of, so you might memorize the numbers specifically and the directions, right 20, left 40, right 20, or maybe you imagine a little pot-bellied Santa Claus whose measurements are 20, 40, 20, and you use that to help you retain what you saw. So that would be the representation or the retentional process. You also might covertly practice that. You might try to repeat it to yourself to remember, and then you might further also practice some of the motor movements. You might kind of start to imagine the skills necessary to open it using either the Santa Claus image or the code, right 20, left 40, right 20, to guide you through those imagined movements. And then you'll go ahead and imitate the motor parts of the behavior, but whether you actually do it all the way through, according to Bandura, is dependent on whether you expect there to be anything valuable in actually doing it. So do you think there is anything in the safe? Or do you think you'll get some other kind of reward for opening the safe? If so, you will go ahead and complete the motor movements and imitate your aunt's behavior. But if not, you may not, because there would be no reason to start any of it, to start any part of the process. So this theory has, I would say, really intuitive appeal. It sounds good. It makes good sense. It's written about very nicely. But it is not without its own problems. The chief among them, I would say, being that we're talking about hypothetical processes here. And so the value of those for actually explaining what's truly going on in the mind of a person is not all that high. If you can't measure a hypothetical process, then how do you know it's even going on? What are we really doing here? What's the point of constructing such a theory? Like, what does it mean to say that attention is self-directed? Sure it is. We all decide what we're going to look at. not all that surprising. How do you measure how self-directed or whether attention is it's unclear how to concretize some parts of Bandura's social cognitive theory. It's also true that motivation is important, but does the expectation of reward truly explain the entirety of why people imitate a model? I'm not confident that it does. If you know that your aunt is rich and rich people have valuable things in safes, then yeah, you might expect that the opening of the safe will be reinforced. But is the expectation of the reward the thing that explains your behavior? Or is it the learning experiences that led to the expectation? How is all of that organized? Bandura's writings are not perfectly clear on those questions. So because of those problems, some researchers prefer explanations that view observational learning more as a form of operant learning. So we move to slide 20. We'll think about the operant learning model. And so these models are any that treat observational learning, again, as a variation of operant learning. So we've already seen that discriminative stimuli play a crucial role in operant conditioning, right? Both inside and outside the laboratory. For instance, a lab animal might learn to make one response in the presence of a red light, another response in the presence of a green light, yet another in the presence of a yellow light. You might also have different responses to all three of those lights when driving, let's say. Observational learning involves situations where that discriminative stimulus is not, say, the color of the light necessarily, but it's the behavior of another person. And the appropriate response just happens to be a similar behavior on the part of the observer. So you as the observer will be looking to the model as your stimulus, and you will just happen to design your response after the model's response. Consider an experiment that Miller and Dollard did. They had first grade kids participate in pairs. One of them was the leader, the other was the learner. And so across several trials, the two kids would enter a room in which there were two chairs with a large box on top of each. The leader was told in advance to go to one particular box, and that there might be a piece of candy inside the box. The learner could see where the leader went, but not whether the leader actually got any candy. So once the leader was done, it was the learner's turn to go to one of the two boxes where he or she might or might not find a piece of candy. Half of the learners were in an imitation group. They were reinforced for making the same choice as the leader. The other half were in the non-imitation group. They got reinforcement if they chose the opposite box from their leader. And the result of this very simple experiment was probably not surprising to you at this point. After a few trials, the kids in the imitation group always copied their leader. The kids in the non-imitation group always made the opposite response. And so Miller and Dollard concluded that, like any other operant response, you can make imitation occur if the individual is reinforced for imitating. Conversely, you can reinforce a person for not imitating, for in fact doing the opposite behavior, and then you will encourage non-imitation. The behavior of the other person isn't automatically imitated. It's only imitated if it is reinforced, if imitation is reinforced. And so in that way, the observer is essentially just one other stimulus from the environment that we choose whether to respond to. Another topic you'll often hear about when talking about observational learning is this concept of mirror neurons. So I just wanted to cover that quickly at the end of this recording. What makes mirror neurons unique is that they fire both when an animal makes a certain movement and when the animal observes someone else making that same movement. They were actually discovered by accident when researchers were recording from individual neurons in a monkey's premotor cortex, which in an area where that involved hand movement and grasping. They found neurons that would fire when a monkey reached for a piece of food, but they noticed that the same neuron fired when the experimenter reached for the piece of food. This is the Di Pellegrino, Fadigia, Galesi, and Rizzolatti paper from 92. And so this discovery of mirror neurons in macaques in the early 90s, and then the eventual discovery of mirror neurons in humans as well, added a whole new dimension to the discussion about whether observational learning is a unique and special type of learning that's different from operant learning. So studies using brain imaging techniques have identified a lot of areas in the human brain that act like this, that do mirror the actions of others. They become active when the person makes a movement and when they observe someone else making the same movement. And you can see quite a lot of that, mostly in motor cortex and some premotor planning cortex kind of areas. And there's a lot of attention placed on mirror neurons in the literature, because brain researchers have speculated that they could be involved in a lot of other important human capabilities because they respond, again, when we act and when we see others act. So they might be part of the network that helps us understand each other's actions or each other's intentions or maybe even each other's feelings. So the theorization has sort of gone quite far into assuming that they may be important for social interaction and communication. And so the area of research that's become quite popular with mirror neurons is research surrounding autism spectrum disorder. So there's a lot of research looking into the functioning of mirror neurons in both children and adults who are on the autism spectrum, comparing them to people who are not on the spectrum. And there's some differences there. The evidence is pretty preliminary, even though this has been going on for something like 10 years now in some labs. And I would say it's incomplete, but if we see a lot more corroboration and replication, if we continue to see the same findings over and over, we would start to have evidence that would help us explain why people on the autism spectrum have difficulties in communication and in understanding other people's intentions. And of course, on a more basic level, it's also been suggested that mirror neurons are important for observational learning and for the processes of imitation, because they might help us make the connections between seeing someone else perform an action and being able to perform it ourselves. So if the species of animals that's most capable of observational learning also has the most developed mirror neuron system, that would be good evidence that that's truly what we're looking at. And so that's something that future researchers are working on, as far as I believe up to now even. Most of the motor neuron, mirror neuron research has been done on humans and other primates. So trying to expand that to other animals and seeing whether it does is a potentially important thing to see. There is one study that I know of with sparrows that found some neurons in their brains that responded both when they sang a specific song and when they heard that specific song. A very cool study by Prather et al. In 2008. So there is some indication that mirror neurons are not a primate unique thing. And so working further and further down that road of all of these questions that the finding of mirror neurons has made available to us is probably the next stage in our understanding of observational learning. And so that finishes this recording. Thanks for listening, and talk to you soon. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about motor cortex, motor learning. We'll start with some of the data, some of the things we know about how people learn their motor skills. And then we'll talk about the theories behind those learnings of motor skills. Talk to you soon.